I am Plant Online. This is the commentary.ca. The world of snakes and the people who pursue and study them for a living is provided a view in a new book, Snake Bit, Confessions of an Herpetologist. The author, Leslie Anthony, who joins me from here in Vancouver, has a PhD in zoology and lectured in herpetology as a postdoctoral fellow at McGill's Redpath Museum. An avid outdoorsman, he's won awards for his poetry and journalism. He is the editor of Peak Performance Magazine. He is a former managing editor of Powder and former creative editor of Skier Magazine. Snake Bit, published by Greystone, retails for $29.95. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Leslie Anthony. Good morning, Dr. Anthony.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. Yourself?
Good, thank you.
Where were you born?
I was born in Toronto, Ontario.
And you grew up there, did you?
I did.
And when was it that you were first interested in snakes?
I didn't even really know what a snake was until I was bitten by one at day camp when I was about 6 years old. And I would say that that piqued my interest. Pretty much from there on, I was obsessed with them.
You were interested in butterflies first, is that right?
Yeah, I had a bit of a fondness for bugs, and you know, I had a grandfather who had pinned out a few butterflies, so I thought that was interesting. And
pinned out, what does that mean?
Oh, you know, they euthanized the butterflies in a jar of mothballs, and then they'd pin them out flat, you know, in a display case.
Ah, okay.
That kind of thing. You do it at museums, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly what it means, yeah. And so, 6 years old, you're bitten by a snake. What kind of snake was it?
Well, it was a completely harmless garter snake, and no harm done. A few little pinpricks on my finger, but the reaction of the people around me, the counselors and the people in the medical tent, and they were quite hysterical, and I found that fascinating. They didn't seem to know what this animal was. They didn't know whether it was harmless or not, and you know, there was an awful kerfuffle about me being bit by the snake, and I think I was drawn to that aspect of it as well, that snakes are a bit of a black hole for humans. Not very well understood, not a lot known. Definite panic.
Garter snakes, are they common throughout, I guess, I don't know, in this country?
Absolutely. The garter snake is probably one of, if not the commonest snake on the planet in terms of its range and sheer numbers. You know, it's found all the way up to the subarctic in the Northwest Territories and in Alaska, and all the way down to Central America, and there's probably 30 some species involved coast to coast as well.
And is it like, do we see them in urban areas?
Yeah, that's one of the hallmarks of the garter snake is, you know, they're the thing that we all probably become familiar with reptiles through, because they are ubiquitous in urban areas. They like urban areas. They find, you know, vacant lots and little patches of woods and the greenery along railroad tracks, great places to live. They'll eat earthworms and slugs and frogs and all the kind of stuff you find there. So kids encounter garter snakes quite a bit.
So when you were 6 years old, you were bitten by this. Did you think there was a chance that you were going to die from it?
No. Actually, I somehow intuitively knew that it wasn't dangerous at all.
Have you been bitten since?
Yeah, thousands of times. Always by harmless snakes, fortunately. Although a lot of people I know have been bitten by venomous snakes.
And so, like, I'm not an outdoors person at all. So I'm wondering, like, you talk about the lack of education we have or the lack of knowledge we have on snakes. If we see a snake, we shouldn't pick it up, right? That's essentially what we should do, right?
Yeah. Not.
I seem to remember in the summer, you know, you would hear about stories up in the Okanagan or so on. There'd be signs up saying, you know, alcohol and snakes do not mix or something like that.
Precisely.
That you shouldn't drink, and that if you are drinking, you shouldn't pick up a snake, because a lot of people think, you know, that, you know, they're invincible, I guess, and they pick up a snake.
Yeah, well, a couple of drinks makes the snake look a lot less dangerous. You know, same thing that applies in bars with women.
So in terms of colors of snakes, I mean, does it really matter? I mean, if a snake is red in color, I guess we assume that that's poisonous, perhaps? Or?
Well, no, not necessarily. It depends what part of the world you live in. I mean, the reddish-colored snakes in Canada are all harmless. Down in the U.S., there's a couple of bad actors called coral snakes that have some red bands on them, but for the most part, reddish snakes are harmless there as well. Get into the tropics, though, and there's lots of red snakes that can kill you.
So when you say that it matters where you are, if, for example, I encounter a snake in the garden or something like that, should I be worried or should I...
Where do you live?
In Vancouver.
You shouldn't be worried at all. We've got three species of garter snakes that lurk in the underbrush around Vancouver, and you know they're very beneficial to the ecosystem of both your backyard and any sort of coastal fog belt forest. They're not going to hurt anything or anybody. They're eating pests basically, and they're just another interesting animal out there.
And these poisonous snakes, I mean, do they serve a purpose as well in the tropics and so on?
Absolutely. Every animal is embedded in an ecosystem to a certain extent or greater, or a lesser or greater extent, I mean. They all have their place, you know. Some of them are, like any animal, where you land up in the trophic level is all about energy transfer, and snakes tend to be good at energy transfer from aquatic to terrestrial ecosystems. For instance, they eat a lot of amphibians, so there's a lot of biomass moving from, you know, water onto land through snake intermediaries, and then you've got animals on land that eat the snakes, and you know, so energy gets moved around that way. And in the tropics, a lot of rodent eating going on, and you know, things like that.
How do you feel about people that keep snakes as pets?
Well, I don't do it. I certainly did when I was younger. After a while, it sort of wore thin on me. I started to wonder, well, why am I keeping these things? I actually enjoy seeing them in nature more. And I guess I sort of grew out of that need to have something on display, you know, to be wearing some sort of badge that said, hey, I'm a snake guy. But a lot of people enjoy snakes as pets, not just because of their ornamental value, which they do have, especially given this enormous pet trade we have now where reptile breeding is a very big industry, and coming up with different color combinations and things is a growth area. But, you know, beyond that ornamental and objet d'art aspect of things, some people actually just enjoy watching them. They like the way snakes move. Ironically, that's what a lot of people don't like about snakes, but you know, they have their own inherent behavioral traits that some people are pretty interested in. And then there's the macabre part. Some people like watching snakes eat what they feed them, you know, yeah, live animals and whatnot.
And you sometimes see these nuts that get, you know, sort of venomous snakes and keep them in their apartments, and then they, you know, they run loose, and you know, it's just you know, a hellish time for everyone.
Yeah, there's really no reason for that kind of thing to be going on, and in fact, I've been to a few invasive species conferences and discussion groups about people who have, you know, wildlife that they keep, that escape for one reason or another. And I would fully advocate, you know, a permit system for keeping any sort of dangerous wildlife, whether it's snakes or, you know, lions, tigers, you know, wild boars even. But certainly venomous snakes really shouldn't be something that anyone outside of a licensed research facility should be keeping. It's simply too dangerous.
But there are snakes, though, that one can keep in the home in a, I don't know what you call it, one of those tanks or something, right?
Yeah, terrarium tank or what. There's all sorts of different species And like I said, this whole pet trade thing going on, a lot of the things that are bred in the pet trade are bred because they make reasonable pets. You know, they're easy to feed. You can keep frozen mice. You know, you don't have to feed them live mice. You can have frozen mice, thaw them out, train your corn snake to eat these things. You know, there's several species of boas and pythons that are fairly quiet, non-aggressive pets. And yeah, so there are certainly some animals out there that are commonly kept as pets.
Herpetology isn't just the study of snakes. What else is involved? I guess reptiles and so on?
Reptiles and amphibians. And this is one of the very interesting things about herpetology. It is the only scientific discipline, certainly biologically, that involves the study of two completely different classes of animals. And this is a strange artifact that goes back to, it's illogical, but, you know, ironically, it goes back to Aristotelian logic. 2,000 years ago or so, Aristotle created a category of animals when he was dividing them all up that he called herpetons, and it basically represented anything that crept or crawled on the earth, because herpeton is the Greek root meaning to creep or crawl. So he threw everything in there: beetles, slugs, snakes, frogs, toads, lizards, worms. And amazingly, despite the fact that that was 2,000 years ago and all the invertebrate zoologists and entomologists have come and got their little buddies back out of that category, somehow the snakes and frogs are still, they're still on this roller coaster together in this thing called herpetology. It's a very, very schizophrenic discipline.
And the book discusses some other herpetologists like yourself. Well, what sort of people make up the field? Are they sort of, I guess you'd have to be interested in animals to begin with. And sort of outdoorsy, is that correct? And is a correct assumption?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the reason I wrote this book is because I'm sort of a lapsed herpetologist. I spent a bunch of years studying it in school. I was obviously interested as a kid. I taught it in university, but then I went on to a career in writing, largely about other things. And you know, at some point, I just became re-fascinated with this group of people that I'd spent a lot of time with. So I went back, sort of a personal excavation, exploration journey, whatnot, to explore, you know, this whole milieu of herpetology and the kind of people that it attracted and why, in some ways, to understand, you know, why I'd been attracted. It was amazing how much symmetry I came across. Almost everyone I talked to had been interested in the same things as kids. You know, they all mentioned praying mantises and toads and, you know, giant water bugs. And basically things that were strange, the strange animals of a child's existence and the things that adults were usually afraid of. These kind of people seemed to gravitate towards herpetology. And, you know, there's all sorts of other personality traits that one might be able to fold into that as well. But again, herpetology is an unconventional science in that there's a core professional community, but then there's this whole hang on periphery of non-professional herpetologists who are just into the hobby of reptiles and amphibians, who just find these animals fascinating and powerful in some way, and indeed wear them as a badge, you know, bikers and strippers and performers and, you know, people who keep these large snakes for ornamental purposes. And it's kind of a weird coattail identity. So you'd have to count those people as also being attracted to herpetology, and maybe there's a little element of that kind of thing in all of us.
I mean, I'm just sort of trying to assign a sort of peculiar trait about you guys, you people. I mean, what would you, I mean, is it just a sense of adventure, I suppose, more than anything?
Absolutely a sense of adventure. And, you know, I think a thirst for knowledge in some respects. I don't think a lack of fear. I think there's some issue of fear in there, but it's more about exploring fear or using fear to your advantage. I mean, I know when I was a kid, I liked being the snake guy because that gave me some power over adults who were scared of snakes and who didn't want to go near them. I think really if the unifying trait is just, interest in the natural world. And I think that can deliver you to an outdoor existence, or perhaps the outdoor existence delivers you to the appreciation of the natural world. I'm not really sure which way it goes, but it's a fairly common thread.
Hey, your career is spent writing about skiing and snowboarding and so on. You live in Whistler.
Mm-hmm.
What scares you? I guess I ask.
Well, I'm scared of venomous snakes. I'll be the first person to admit that. I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time hanging out with these people, but I'm not the guy who's out there pinning cobras on the ground. I'm the guy who's standing 2 meters away writing about it. You know, I'm part of the milieu, but I'm not, you know, a particular part of it. I was mostly an amphibian guy. So I'm fascinated with, what it takes for these people to be comfortable doing that kind of stuff. You know, I have my fears. I mean, we all have our fears. If you didn't have a fear in things you're doing, then, you know, you wouldn't be very careful about it. I'm scared of a lot of things in the mountains as well, of course. I'm scared of avalanches and rock fall and cliffs and, you know, things that I try and obviate by, you know, viewing them as objective hazards and learning what I can about them and making the right choices. Same deal with people who are handling venomous snakes. It's an objective hazard. You learn what you can, you obviate what danger you can by approaching them and handling them properly. And of course, just like in climbing and skiing, somebody's going to make a mistake every once in a while, but
I guess for me, I mean, if someone walked into this room right now with a snake, I would probably not, I would probably move away faster than you would. Now, that's a common reaction for a lot of people. I'm sort of wondering, do you
extremely.
Get, yeah, how do you get over that fear? I mean, you obviously have.
Well, I guess I never had that fear, or I never indulged it. It is believed that there is an inherent fear of snakes in humans, but that it needs to be environmentally triggered. There's been a whole series of experiments done with monkeys and whatnot and other primates showing that this is the case. However, you know, fear of snakes being inborn is one of, if not the most common phobia among humans, ophidiophobia, or herpetophobia, as it's sometimes called if it's extended to reptiles in general. So it's incredibly common, and the way to get over it is really the way you get over anything, you know, some sort of knowledge, understanding, education, and some hands-on effort is usually required. You know, you need to, people are afraid of snakes for all sorts of different reasons. A lot of people just find the way they move to be creepy. The lack of legs is something that sets them off. The tongue, maybe. People think they're slimy, but they're dry. You know, if someone gets a chance to touch one, you know, there's a bit of progress right there. They realize that they're not quite what they thought. Getting over a fear of snakes is probably, if you have a really deep fear of snakes, probably not something that can happen very quickly, but you have to put some effort into it. You have to get with someone who's going to help you through it, and you're probably going to have to touch a snake, I think.
What's it like being bitten by a venomous snake?
Well, I don't know from personal experience, but I think it's extremely unpleasant.
Yeah, like what happens? I mean, I was reading about it, and I was reading about what happens to a person after they've been bitten by a venomous snake, and it freaked me out.
Well, again, it depends on what the snake was, how bad the bite was, how much venom was injected, what kind of venom it was, and what the person's physiological and psychological state is. I would say if you're dealing with, let's just talk about vipers, rattlesnakes, that group of snakes, for instance, they got pretty big fangs. And they basically work like a hypodermic needle. They're hollow. The venom is produced in sacs at the side of the head, modified saliva sacs. And when they bite and those teeth go into you, the muscles compress those sacs and the venom flows through into the skin and flesh. A bite from a viper or a rattlesnake is painful to start because their fangs are fairly large. And, you know, they're penetrating the skin like nails, essentially. So you've got that initial pain. And then right away, the venom that they carry, being a tissue-destroying and blood-destroying kind of venom, starts to cause symptomatic reactions. Histamines are released. You know, anti-allergy physiology takes over. Swelling, you know, edema, some fairly nasty stuff that also increases the pain factor. If, on the other hand, you're bitten by a cobra or a relative of a cobra, like a krite or a sea snake, something that's neurotoxic, you often don't even feel the bite. The fangs are tiny. You might feel no more than a scratch or not even anything. There may be no symptoms at the site of the bite. You may actually feel nothing for a while, possibly even an hour. And then very, very slowly, the neurotoxic venom begins to find its way to the areas of the body where its actions take place. The breathing apparatus, you know, the eye movement, you know, your eyes may become paralyzed, your breathing may become shallow and slow down. All the autonomic functions tend to be affected. So, you know, very, very different situations from those two types of snake groups.
Well, when you say there's a difference in terms of what one psychological state is, if we freak out, will that
the outcome is far, far worse if you're agitated, if you're panicking, because A, you speed up the blood flow, so you spread the venom more quickly around your system, and B, you're likely to do something stupid that will make the outcome worse. Perhaps you'll run. Perhaps you will resort to some old wives' tale, like slashing the flesh around the bite and trying to suck the venom out, and thereby causing massive tissue damage and possible later infection. So, you know, you're better off if you've got your head about you and you know what you're supposed to do, and then you can get yourself some medical help.
Yeah, and read this book so that we would know more about snakes, I guess, right?
Well, perhaps, but there's nothing really practical in there about snake bite. This is a very philosophical book that weaves together a lot of threads of adventure and travel and just the, you know, the personality of these people and the interesting science behind the animals they chase. There are definitely some good practical books out there for outdoors people if they want to know, you know, what kind of first aid procedures they should be looking at for snake bite.
Leslie, I appreciate your time today and continued good luck with the book. This is a wonderful primer for those of us who are terribly afraid of snakes.
Hey, well, don't worry. There's plenty of frogs and salamanders and turtles and lizards in there, too, so you won't be freaked out on every page.
We should pay attention to those, too, I guess. The book is called Snake Bit: Confessions of a Herpetologist, $29.95, published by Greystone. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Plana.